Hi, I'm Mike Collins. We'll get to the Charlotte Talks podcast in just a moment. First, I want to tell you about a special public conversation I'm hosting, and you're invited to join me and several of Charlotte's African-American leaders for Building an Inclusive City. That's on February 21st, 7 p.m. at Spirit Square. We'll be talking with Charlotte's mayor, police chief, city manager, and district attorney. Details and free registration at WFAE.org, and we hope to see you there. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We're near the halfway point in the school year, a good time to check back on some stories and trends that we've been following. Back in January, the CMS School Board voted 7-2 to take a stronger stand on supporting LGBTQ rights. That met with both praise and criticism. The State Board of Education is anticipating making cuts to the budget even as the legislature takes a step back on mandating smaller class sizes in grades K through 3, a new study from an education reform think tank finds that the gifted gap, which shortchanges Black and Hispanic students nationwide, is particularly bad here in North Carolina. We're going to take a deeper dive on those and many other education developments in the coming hour. We have four education reporters with us. I'll bet you didn't know we had four education reporters, but we do. The Charlotte Observer's and Helms is back with us. Good morning. Welcome
back.
Good
morning.
Liz Bell is with us from, she's a reporter for EdNC out of Raleigh. Thank you for joining us in the studio of all places.
Thanks for having me.
Who knew? Dedrick Russell is education reporter with WBTV. Good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, sir.
And Gwendolyn Glenn is here from WFAE News. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
As we go through the show, if you'd like to join our conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can watch us this morning on Facebook Live. Let us start with equity, which you say, Anne, is the overriding question for the year ahead being 2018. And by that, I believe you mean the question is, does everybody get a fair shot? Does a smart kid at Harding High School get the same shot at a good education that a smart kid at Providence will get? Are Black kids held to different standards in terms of their behavior and how they're judged with that? Are schools in poorer areas as good? Are the teachers as good as those in wealthier areas? And this is not the first time we've asked those questions.
Not
at all.
It's
been going on forever.
Right.
Has anything changed? Are those questions still coming up with bad answers?
Well, there are not easy answers, and I think that's the real challenge. When you talk about it in the very broad strokes, and you're right, this dates back at least to the turn of the century when they were getting out from under the court-ordered race-based assignment and looking at a system that they knew was going to create extreme concentrations of poverty and disadvantage. And the school board then and the county commissioners then said, we know this means you can't just slice up the pie and give everybody an even chunk of resources. We know schools with big challenges are going to take extra resources. And so a lot of the early years of equity focused on almost remedial help. They don't like that term, but looking at the schools that had very low pass rates, very low graduation rates, and saying, what do we need to get those kids up to the floor?
Yeah.
And we've, of course, had multiple changes of leadership since then. We've got now a relatively new superintendent, three very new school board members. So they're sitting down to ask the age-old question, okay, we know we want to do this. We know that every child, whatever their abilities or disabilities, ought to be able to achieve their full potential no matter where they are. How do we do this? And that starts by how do we define this? And Dedrick and I both spent some quality time Saturday with the school board kind of going through this with a moderator. And how do you measure it? Because, again, you have to have some kind of measure, and those measures tend to be very difficult. They did an equity report and then kind of pushed it to the side and are getting ready to try it again.
So, Dedrick, given the fact that we have been talking about this forever, on Saturday when you and Ann went to that school board meeting and that moderated discussion, did you learn anything new? Are they taking a different point of view on this?
Well, I just think that this is the turning point, that this is the opportunity where they have to do something. No more talk. It has to be action, because they have not revised the equity policy for about 8 years, since 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's a new superintendent in place. Now, as Ann said, three new school board members and one school board member is very interested in equity. Now they have to do something, because at the meeting, at the retreat, they said that we have to make sure that we have to be specific and we have to be intentional, that no matter where a child is, that child has to get the best, has to have access, has to have access. And I did a story just last week about AP courses, advanced placement courses, where they're located. When you go to South Mech High has 30 AP courses offered to students. When you go to Harding University High School, only 5 AP courses. So now I presented that to the school board. They know that there is a problem. They know that there is an equity problem in the district. So now what are you going to do about it? So now the superintendent is supposed to unveil his equity report at the end of this month. The school board and superintendent is supposed to go back to revise, to tweak, to massage the equity policy to make sure that no matter where a student is in CMS, that they will have access to opportunities.
I want to come back to that AP story that you did, advanced placement course story, in a second. Gwendolyn.
I was going to say that I talked to a couple of the board members afterwards, and one thing that Ruby Jones was saying was that they are having a problem coming up with a definition of what is equity, and that they're still
really
fiddling with that and trying to, she said, we're at a starting point. And I talked to a couple other board members, and they said the same thing, that it looks different to different people, different board members. They have different views, and that they are still kind of struggling with that first, and also looking at whether or not, as Jessica said, the report is coming out from the superintendent, whether or not those reports should be more than just, is it every 3 years, annually, or?
It was supposed to be. I believe their policy says they will do one annually, and they haven't done it for
a
number of years.
Exactly.
So what are some of the different points of view on what equity is? Did they give you individual definitions of how they saw equity? If everybody has a different idea of what it is?
They brought up a little bit of everything from racially, economically, in terms of quality of teachers, in terms of school buildings, in terms of environment of schools. So it was kind of like a long list, and how do we bring all of this together in terms of
And they looked at a policy from Roanoke City Schools that was much more detailed than theirs, and it even included things like school size. Their equity policy literally says schools shall be no larger than this and no smaller than that, which I think the Charlotte Mecklenburg board members kind of looked at that and said, wow, that's not necessarily practical, because that depends on money that doesn't come from us.
Exactly. And I just wanted to say, they did come up with a definition on Saturday, and the definition of equity, providing the opportunities, support settings, resources, and high standards so that all students can achieve a high quality education and contribute to a thriving community. So that is one of the definitions of the school
board. I was going to say one of them. I don't think it's the final.
It was two. A work in progress.
Yeah, that was one. So now they're going to put those two definitions together to come up with their definition.
Liz, give us a 30,000-foot view here. Is this going on everywhere in the state, or is this just Charlotte-Mecklenburg?
Absolutely it is. When it comes to educational issues, equity is something that touches every corner of the education landscape. As you guys pointed out, there are tons of different lenses to look at equity through, right? Race, socioeconomic status, gender, geography. But it is when you zoom into the classroom or individual level, you know, we find that Black students, students of color, have worse academic and discipline outcomes. And it is also a systemic issue when we zoom out to the statewide system. And an example of that is there's this increasingly diversifying student population and a teacher workforce that hasn't really caught up to that yet. And research has shown that, especially for a student of color, it makes a difference in their academic outcomes and their ability to learn to have a teacher who looks like them in the building.
Well, if we know, and we've known this for years, that African American and Hispanic students don't do as well, that the schools in poorer areas of cities and towns are not as well equipped as the more affluent area schools, when they're sometimes their teachers perhaps aren't as good because they don't want to teach in those schools, when there are not as many AP classes available to students who could do them, could do the work. If we know all this, why are we still talking about it? It's 2018, for crying out loud.
Because it's a lot easier to identify a problem than to solve it. And again, it's not as if they've done nothing and just kind of sat there and, you know, twiddled their thumbs. There have been, at the school board retreat, they started ticking off things that they have done to try to address equity. And that ranges from Project Lift and the Beacon Initiative, which identifies some low-performing, high-poverty schools and try to provide teacher bonuses, recruitment efforts, extra resources. They talked about a staffing formula that already gives more teachers to the most disadvantaged schools. They talked about the work they're doing with the discipline policy to try to stop throwing so many young black boys out of school for minor infractions when they're, you know, as young as kindergartners. So they've tried all these things, but nothing has been the fix.
So at this meeting on Saturday, evidently, board members compared our system's policy to that of the Roanoke, Virginia city schools. You can tell me why that system in particular, but you wrote that, Ann, that the Roanoke policy has several benchmarks, and they require an annual equity report. And in comparison, our policy is, quote, fluffy.
That was Rhonda Cheek's description, not mine, but yes.
Okay, what does that mean, fluffy?
Ours is short. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School's policy is short. It doesn't give a lot of detail. But the detail it does give, they're not doing. It literally refers to these school quality reviews, which were done probably a decade ago, and they were really deep dives, not just on the data, but on visits and observations at each school to say, here's what's working well and here's what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And again, that was something that went in with a lot of enthusiasm under one superintendent. Well, we've had, you know, three or four since then. That was expensive. It fell by the wayside. This is what tends to happen.
Is there a system in the state that does this well, Liz? Or are they all struggling with this?
I think that everyone is, districts across the street, across the state, are trying tons of different things, and there isn't one silver bullet to fix all of these complex layers. I think it's about kind of a shift in mindset of what education means and looking outside of just a student in a classroom and what their test scores bring, right? That it's looking at did that student have enough to eat this morning? Right. And how is that affecting them in the classroom? How is healthcare and housing and economic situations? How are all of these things affecting students' ability to learn?
You mentioned Rhonda Cheek. She is a school board vice chair. And she says that our policy is about equitable distribution of resources. The Roanoke City School policy is about academic and educational success for all kids. What's the difference? There must be a difference. Are they looking at the difference?
To use the corporate jargon, it's inputs and outputs. You know, the equitable distribution of resources says, well, we've divvied up our technology, our books, maybe our faculty. I think the faculty is the elusive question out there. I think if you could get equally good faculty at every school, you would not have a magic solution, but you'd be closer than anybody's ever been. And that is very hard to measure and very hard to enforce. There's always been talk about, we're going to find our best teachers and we are going to forcibly assign them to the schools that most need them. Well, then they may be forcibly reassign themselves to private schools or across county lines or whatever. So that's These are some very elusive things.
And then when you look at the Roanoke City, I'm looking at its policy right now, and one of the goals, it says student enrollment should not exceed school capacity. So they're looking at overcrowded. So targeted student enrollment, excluding preschool for grades K through 5, is between 300 and 750. So they're targeting overcrowding. All teachers at each school will be highly qualified. So that's in Roanoke City's equity policy. So I guess they're targeting overcrowding, quality teachers, and making sure that students have counselors there to make sure that they're guiding them. And I know that counselors, you know, we don't have as many counselors in CMS that we need. So Roanoke City is going a holistic approach in order to make sure that each child, no matter what school they're in, that they won't have to face overcrowding and that they'll have a counselor to guide them through where they need to go.
So if we have equitable distribution of resources, if that's our policy and what it focuses on, that doesn't explain why we don't have equal access to AP courses. And we'll come back and get a little update on that from Dedrick Russell from WBTV News. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're catching up on some trends and stories in the world of education that we've touched on here and there and maybe not talked about at all until today in many cases with Andos Helms, Liz Bell from Andos Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Liz Bell from EdNC, Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News, all education reporters, by the way, and Edric Russell, WBTV News. You did a story, as you said, last week about AP classes, which evidently are not equally distributed throughout the CMS system. And you spoke with one student, Jayla Green, who said that she'd be interested in AP psychology, AP music theory, AP environmental science, AP chemistry, and AP U.S. history. This is a smart girl.
Exactly.
AP U.S. history.
She wants to be a doctor. Yes.
Okay, but she goes to Harding, and those classes are not offered there. And Green says, quote, "They stereotype us as if we don't want to learn. We just want to fool around." Is that a conscious decision on the part of the schools, or is just that just because of something else going on? I'm not going to ask the question.
Yeah, no, that's a sad commentary, but I talked to CMS about it, and you know, they tell me that the reason – well, they tell me why AP courses are offered – so much at South Mecca opposed to Harding.
And that reason for that is?
The reason is student enrollment, so how many people would be interested, how many people would enroll in an AP psychology class. Also student achievement, so if you have students who are not there yet with calculus, then why would you offer AP calculus? Also parent and student involvement, interest in it. So, but with that said, if there is one student who is interested in taking that AP course, then it is up to that school to make sure that that student has access.
And do they?
Well, not all. So now CMS is working with a third party to make sure that that access is granted. So I talked to the school board chairwoman, Mary McCray, and she says that it's up to the counselor. The counselor at the school, so if Jayla wanted to get AP U.S. history, she needs to go to her counselor, and her counselor needs to push and needs to find a way to Jayla to have access to that. So we need to figure out if everybody is doing what they need to do.
Why isn't that the superintendent's job to make sure that's available? Why is that a counselor's job?
Well, I guess the counselor is there as boots on the ground. The counselor is boots on the ground. So the superintendent can't be, you know, at 178 schools. But I did talk to the superintendent about this.
Okay.
So the superintendent, he said that in his budget coming up, that in his budget, he should address some of these equity problems. So he brought up a point that we need to set our students up for success. So if we have Johnny at Harding University who wants to do AP calculus, but he's having problems with calculus and he can't get the tutoring, but a student at South Mech whose son is having problems in calculus, well, that parent can take that child to Sylvan Learning Center and get all the tutoring and the support that they need.
So because now, they have the money.
Exactly.
To do it. Yeah.
So if little Johnny at Harding doesn't have the money to get that extra tutoring, to get that extra help in calculus, then what will CMS do? So the superintendent said that maybe we need to make sure that we have the services and the support for that person in any school to offer that tutoring to help them get over the hump.
I'm sure that Jayla Green is not the only student at Harding who would like to take some AP courses, and maybe not all the same AP courses. Maybe somebody else wants to take AP biology, which she didn't mention.
Exactly.
So if they go to a counselor, what have counselors been able to do to get them access to those classes?
Well, sometimes they can do the online learning. They can do virtual where they could go online and get that AP course. But then the scheduling could be a problem as well because, you know, that AP online could be only offered during 10 to 11. But then I have another class I need to go from 10 to 11. So CMS now has to make sure they connect the dots. They're leaving no child behind.
And you do have to be realistic that resources are not unlimited. Teachers are not unlimited. So in an ideal world.
Why can't you put a camera in the classroom at South Mech and put it on the internet and stream it to the kids?
They do some of that.
They do that.
And that is, again, it's not easy to solidly measure. And I think that Dedrick's story did some really important groundwork. There are other advanced college credit opportunities. There are international baccalaureate classes, which Harding has. There's a Cambridge program that a few schools are using. Every school has opportunities to take classes through Central Piedmont Community College, which literally are college-level classes that you get credit for. So, again, it's not easy to measure and quantify. But that real question does come down to a school where maybe at one school you have 30 students who want AP psychology, and at another school you have one or two, and you can't just randomly bring in a teacher to sit there and wait for those one or two. You have to allocate the faculty you have. So,
well, it's 2018, and we have good teachers all over the state. So why couldn't you find the best teacher in AP Calculus and the best teacher in AP U.S. History in the state and put them in front of a camera at 11 o'clock or 1 o'clock, whatever the school periods are, and transmit that all over the state? Has that been discussed, Liz?
As Anne mentioned before, you know, excellent educators, excellent administration, being in every school, especially schools with high needs, that's one of the main issues being discussed, right? How do we, especially in rural areas, how do we attract high-quality educators and administrators? And one thing that's being done, I know in Edgecombe and I think in a couple other rural districts, is actually having students get involved who would be interested in teaching early on, right? In middle school, in high school, start to have gain teaching experience in the classroom and kind of create a homegrown pipeline of high quality educators who are also from the area and have reason to stay in the area and also understand the culture and the dynamics of that area, because, you know, sometimes that can be an issue that a teacher will come for a couple years and then get burned out or want to move somewhere else for other reasons. So that's something we've seen rural districts specifically try to implement.
And North Carolina does have a virtual public school. So this idea that you're talking about does exist. Whether they're the best teachers or not, I don't know. I would say that if you are the best AP history teacher in the state, and you had a choice between doing a virtual job where you would be speaking into a camera versus maybe going into one school where you would have a handful of students who are ready versus going into a school that has a strong tradition of AP history and you're going to be hands-on face-to-face with students who have, you know, a lot of aptitude, a lot of support from home, and you're making that choice, I think that tends to be one of the reasons that you see the best advanced teachers going into the schools that have a tradition of really strong support for advanced classes.
And that's why it's so important. You have to, that's the superintendent, the Board of Education, that is their job. That is what they ran for. That is what they signed up for, to make sure that every child has access. And the sad thing about it is that if those AP courses are not offered in those high poverty schools, that student will never know how far he or she would go in their academic career. And that's what I'm looking at, that if you don't challenge me, I would never know how far I can go. So that's why it is up to the community, up to the pastors, up to parents to make sure that they're pushing, make sure they're telling the school board members that you said you're going to commit it to equity. So I want to see a report card in 6 months. What have you done? And you need to keep doing that until we reach the finish line.
Gwendolyn.
And again, when you talk about the virtual classrooms, a lot of students, they don't do well with that kind of learning. They need more feedback.
Right.
And that's something that some other districts have talked about, that that's not an option for everybody. And some have even had pilot programs where, say, for instance, a young lady like you talked about, they provide transportation for them to go to a school that offers, and it's not that that child would spend her whole day there, but go back and forth. But when you talk to CMS officials a lot of times about transportation, they'll say, oh, we don't have the money because transportation is a problem.
And it takes hours out of the day.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So
I do know that the North Carolina School of Science and Math have made efforts. They have an online program to reach students in rural areas and across the state who have an appetite for these rigorous courses but aren't receiving them in their districts or in their schools. And they also do some virtual classrooms and have partnerships with districts where, you know, they have a lot of the best of the best right there as far as educators go. So
So Deb in Fourth Ward writes or emails, will it take another court suit for the school board to truly address equity? Surely we are in a separate but unequal situation.
Well, a lot of the major changes that have happened here have happened in response to lawsuits. And I believe the Leandro case, which has been going on, it feels like, since I was born, and is a statewide case, and Liz might be able to speak better to that, is still out there in some way, shape, or form. It actually outlived the judge who was enforcing a lot of it. Judge Howard Manning became quite a presence in Charlotte when he said, your high schools are committing academic genocide. Shape up or you're going to hear more from me. So do you know where that
yes,
stands?
Yes, there is a hearing on Thursday. Wow. And it has been obviously ongoing for many, many, many years.
Okay. Is this the same thing, Anne, as the gifted gap that you wrote about that shortchanges Black and Hispanic students across America and which is apparently worse, much worse, in North Carolina? Is this the same thing?
The gifted gap is a subset of the equity question, and it very much speaks to the same thing that Dedrick is speaking to, that if you are Black or Hispanic, no matter what school you're in, you're less likely to be identified as gifted. And I don't think anybody really believes that there are fewer brilliant children of color. It's just that the system itself of identifying and or the development that a child gets at home can affect that. So this is, again, a national situation. The numbers were even a little lower in North Carolina. Then if you are a Black or Hispanic child who is sent to a high-poverty school where most of the students are coming in with a lot of disadvantages, then your chances of getting those advanced opportunities get even much, much slimmer. And that's where we were really among the lowest in the nation. And if you look at which district in North Carolina has A, the most children of color, and B, the most high-poverty schools, guess what? We're here,
it's
Charlotte,
us, yeah.
Mecklenburg.
The Thomas Fordham Institute did this study, and they say that their study demonstrates that, quote, the education system's inability or unwillingness to do what it takes to develop the potential of hundreds of thousands of capable young people who hail from modest backgrounds cause us to lose potential Einsteins. And they say no district in North Carolina has more poor Black and Hispanic students than we do. How long have we known this?
Quite a while. I mean, we used to be the largest district in North Carolina, period, and Wake County took over several years ago, but Wake is whiter and more affluent than Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, and we also, Charlotte-Mecklenburg, went to this system, this race-neutral combination of choice and neighborhood boundaries tend to reflect neighborhood affluence, so this has been, for a long time, the district that's had a lot of extremely high concentrations of poverty.
Gwendolyn.
One thing, when I looked at that study, that next door, South Carolina, was number 7 in terms of having the highest number of African-American and Hispanic students enrolled in gifted programs.
Wow.
And one thing that, when I looked at it, that one line that said, prone to bias, favoritism, and abuse is why more Hispanic and African-Americans are not getting into the gifted program. And when you think about that, you know, you come across where students talk. I've talked to students not just here but in other parts of the country who say, my teacher or no one told me about this, or I said I wanted to get in this program and we're not allowed to get in the program, or I had to really fight to get in the program or push or be recognized. And a lot of times it has been said that when students have teachers who look like them, they are more prone to recognize those diamonds in the rough,
right,
regardless how, say, this child has potential, and also those who are excelling to give them those opportunities and talk to them about the so that line's prone to that bias and favoritism.
Yeah.
That's something that is a big factor here.
Jeffrey on Twitter, the solution is simple. He says, desegregate the schools. Balance each school's race and economic populations. It won't fix everything, but it will vastly improve the situation. I thought we had desegregated schools.
Well, Peter Gorman used to say, the only answer that I know is wrong is the one that starts with, this is simple. And I'm going to say, you know, with all due respect to our listener, if anybody thinks desegregating the schools is simple, they haven't been here for the last 20 years.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about class size and some other things. Last year, the legislature mandated lower class sizes for children in K through 3. Right now, I believe those classes have, what, 24 students in them, first grade, second grade, third grade? At least that's what I read yesterday, depending on the grade. But lawmakers wanted to decrease that number to 16, 17, or 18. You're talking to a guy who in first grade had 52 people in his class.
And look how well you turned out.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And the same thing in second, 50 people in the second grade. How much of a difference, the difference in number, but I can't do the math because obviously I failed that, but between 16 and 24, that's not that many kids. Does that really make that much of a difference?
It's hard to say exactly what the number is. There is research showing that all other things being equal, smaller class sizes help, mm-hmm. and they tend to help more with the kids who most need the help. So it is a good thing. I think anybody who thinks that we can lock in class sizes and that will fix all the problems is in for a big disappointment. That's one of the reasons that the research can be so murky, because already a lot of the most disadvantaged schools have extra teachers and have smaller class sizes, and that does not, that basically the bigger factors are the one that the kids bring with them, mm-hmm. whether they're being read to and talked to at home, whether they've got all that stability that helps them focus on classwork. So there are still bigger factors than class size with so many of these things. You know, if you approve millions of dollars, you want to see it fixed like that. You won't, but it may help.
So they wanted to do this, but then the unintended consequence reared its ugly head, and that was the fact if you want to do this, you got to come up with more teachers and you got to come up with more classrooms, and there was no money to do that. So they've backed off. The legislature is backing off implementing this until when? 2022?
They have 4 years.
Be phased in, right.
To do this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it their intent to find the money for this going forward at the
legislature? So part of the issue that we heard from a lot of districts was the way that the state allotted funding to districts was tied into that classroom teacher allotment was tied into enhancement teachers, mm-hmm. which are extracurricular teachers for classes like music and physical education and art. And the funding for those positions was supposed to come out of this flexibility that the legislature provided years back. So taking away that flexibility took away the funding for those enhancement teachers. But in the proposed legislation that the House is actually voting on, debating and voting on in, I think, 20 minutes, they, like you said, those class size restrictions are going to be phased in over 4 years. And the legislature next year is providing $60 million in a separate allotment specifically for enhancement teachers.
Wow. And so, I guess they really wanted to do this because they wanted every child to be on grade level in reading by third grade. So lawmakers thought that by
smaller class sizes,
then you'll be able to get that so that reading can go up. But I know Senator Joel Ford, he believes that everybody is doing this because it's an election year.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about this and other things when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here talking about education and various different education issues with Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News, Dedrick Russell from WBTV News, Liz Bell, Ed NC, and Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Government leaders, business leaders, education leaders, they all agree that lowering class size and getting kids a really fundamental grounding in education in those early years is really the only way to break the cycle of poverty. They've all said this. The question is how to pay for it, I suppose. And is that because those who fund education haven't done a complete buy-in on this? Or is it because the money's simply not there?
We know that's a very tricky, you know, first of all, you can find research to support anything that you want. So I know when Dr. Gorman was here, I know they said that research showed that it mattered not the class size, but it mattered the effective teacher. That if you have an effective teacher in that classroom, an effective teacher can handle 30, 32 students. When you talk about funding is needed, but then you can say you just can't throw money at the problem because that has been done before, where you have thrown money at, you know, the High School Challenge and Project Lift and Beacon, you know, even though progress is happening, but the needle is not moving fast enough. So, you know, so you have once upon a time, state leaders once said that it's not all about the money, that we give you money and we still don't get the results that we need. So it's about the allocation and how school leaders use that money, how they use all that money, use their resources, because you have resources that's not always financial. You can have other resources. That's why you're pulling in from the community and all this. So it's a delicate situation, but you just have to find the smart people who can connect the dots and who could use what they have in order to make progress happen for every child. Because I think 2018 is time out for excuses. You know, no more excuses, because the time you use excuses, we're missing a whole generation.
It seems to be a running theme in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area, right? The time for talk is over. The time for action is now.
But what you hear a lot of district people and people in other parts of the state talking about in terms of the money is that, okay, we're going to have to do this, but we're going to also have to hire additional teachers. That's going to cost money. Buildings, where are we going to, in our schools that are already overcrowded, where are we going to get the space to put these additional classrooms that this will require? So that is a big money issue.
And that happens at Elizabeth Lane Elementary. CMS uses that. They need like around extra class, up to seven extra classrooms.
Right.
But they have no space on that property to even put in more mobile classrooms. So the superintendent says that because this is a phase-in program, that we will now have time to figure all of this out. But they have to start figuring it out right now.
And that's where the blanket solutions kind of fall apart, because Elizabeth Lane doesn't really need any help getting kids up to grade level on reading. They've got virtually all their kids up to grade level. So a smaller class size there might be a nice thing for their teachers, but it's not going to be really part of that solution.
So right now, about 62,000 low-income children are eligible for the free North Carolina pre-K classes, but only about 47% of those young people are being served. How much would it cost to get that number up to 100%?
I think we're looking at, there was a proposal for additional money, and I think it's saying that it would start phasing in at $28 million a year and rise to $77 million a year.
Wow. Money.
Yeah. Representative. And again, that's another thing that a lot of people would say that is a key. If you can provide that universal high-quality pre-kindergarten, that's going to make a big difference. But again, if you believe you can put your money into that and then walk away and say problem solved, you're going to be looking at third grade scores that are no different.
So Representative Craig Horn, who is a Union County Republican and co-chairs a number of House Education Committees, believes that early education should be available to every child in the state. He believes it's critical to the future of the state and the nation, but he adds whether or not it should be government funded is a separate issue. I thought public schools were government funded. Is this a shift in the way we look at public education, or an attempt to move away from public education?
Well, I don't know. I guess the law states that I guess they're responsible for K-12 education, and I guess that's what a lot of people say, that we're responsible for K-12
not
education,
pre-K.
Not pre-K-12. Okay. Pre-K is just a little cherry on top that, you know, we're going to add that in, because for so long that our kindergartens have been coming to school behind. So, you know, and not everybody could afford the pre-K. So now there's an argument now that if we want our kids to be on grade level by the third grade, then maybe we need to do more, and maybe we need to offer that pre-K.
And at the state level, that has been a huge, huge conversation. Everyone's talking about pre-K, and there's actually a new interagency council, the B3 interagency council, that has officials both from the Department of Public Instruction, which is over kindergarten through 12th grade, and the Department of Health and Human Services, which has generally, historically, been over early childhood education. So we're seeing a lot of bipartisan support and interagency collaboration.
And Mike, I need to clarify the numbers I gave. Those were just for Mecklenburg County, because Mecklenburg County commissioners are looking at trying to expand their spending on that. So it's an even much, much bigger number if we're looking
statewide. So the 62,000 is Mecklenburg County. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's that would actually be to add about 6,500. So that's that's a small fragment of the statewide challenge.
Lawmakers have been looking at changing how the state funds K through 12 education. A study says that the current system, which hands out about $9 billion in funding to public schools is outdated, complex, and difficult to understand, and it favors wealthier counties and larger urban districts. So the General Assembly has assembled a task force to study this. Where does that stand?
You know, I think that they're still discussing what's best, but the move is, instead of putting money in allotments for classroom materials for different, you know, categories, they want the money to instead follow the particular student wherever they may go.
Okay. If schools are important to the future of the state and to the nation, it would follow then that the state of education in a state is important. Where does North Carolina rank in terms of public education? Anybody know?
I don't think there is one
know.
Simple. Okay, then I would question the validity of any simple ranking, but tell us what our ranking is.
According to Education Week Research Center, 40th. We rank 40th in the nation. They gave us a C+ for people's chance for success, a D when it comes to finance, a D+ on academic achievement.
And keep in mind that the stats that they use were from 2015 school year. So a lot of people believe that the next time they do this study, North Carolina, it will be a little bit better, because I guess since then there's been a little bit more money that has been invested in North Carolina education. But there's still some issues here in North Carolina when it comes to the 40th with teacher and how much and per pupil expenditure.
So while we have all these problems that we've been talking about with regard to equity and getting kids access to the classes that they want and need and that they're smart enough to be part of, et cetera, we're still waiting for a decision from the state's top court on whether legislators can interpret the state constitution in a way that gives control of about $10 billion in public school funding to an elected superintendent or to the appointed state school board. The board is appointed, I believe, by the governor. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and the elected superintendent is a Republican? Is
yes.
that right? So why is this an issue? Is this just politics at play now in Raleigh? Is that what all these other problems we have when we're playing politics? Is that what this is?
Well, it certainly seems to have that in common, that you have this whole dynamic in Raleigh of the Republican legislature trying to consolidate its power and the Democratic governor trying to, you know, avoid changes that take power away from him.
It's for 150 years, the school board, the state school board, made up of gubernatorial appointees, made all these decisions. Now the legislature wants to boost State Superintendent Mark Johnson's role. What power then did previous state school superintendents have?
I think it's a dynamic that isn't new. And actually, June Atkinson, who was a Democrat, had similar concerns about having enough authority and autonomy to make an impact. And actually, last Wednesday, the state Supreme Court heard arguments from Superintendent Mark Johnson from the state of North Carolina and from the State Board of Education, kind of trying to figure that out, who is ultimately accountable.
Yeah. Well, evidently, the largest teachers group in the state don't like Mark Johnson very much. They snubbed him by not inviting him to an annual convention of the North Carolina Association of Educators because they say his policies are clearly destructive to the state's public schools. What is he trying to do that they don't like? What is clearly destructive about his policies?
Well, I hope Liz knows more about the Raleigh politics of that, but this all stemmed from some comments that he made about $35,000 being pretty good pay for a starting teacher, and that was taken as an insult by a lot of NCAE members. There is a partisan thing going there, too. NCAE has traditionally been very Democratic-leaning, and Mark Johnson is a Republican. So this tension has been building, and this might be.
Yeah, I mean, the tension between the state board and Superintendent Johnson is pretty obvious at State Board of Education meetings. You know, there's kind of this lawsuit looming over his time in office. There has been this lawsuit looming over his time in office so far. And so it's going to be interesting to – he's made comments that this is kind of keeping – he has his hands tied in a way. So it's going to be interesting to see – what he actually does, if he does come out with a victory in this battle, what his priorities will really be and how he will use that new freedom.
Okay.
And also some teachers are upset because it's taking a long time for teachers to get their license in North Carolina. It's taking like 6 to 8 weeks, or they're taking 6 months for a process that should take a month. It's taken 6 months to get these teachers hired. And so some teachers are blaming, you know, this is happening under his watch. And so, and he's young, and he's a former West Charlotte High School teacher. So, so a lot of teachers are just coming after him.
Okay. When a new CMS superintendent, Clayton Wilcox, came to town, he launched a search for a new HR director in the school system, which employs 19,000 people and recruits 1,000 new teachers every single year. What happened to the old head of HR?
She is now doing a different administrative position. There's always been this tension of, do we need an educator who really understands the dynamics of a classroom, or do we need somebody from the corporate world who maybe has a fresher viewpoint on HR? We've tried both. It seems to be a very difficult position that turns over every couple of years. Certainly every time there's a new superintendent, they always say, HR is one of the things we really need to fix, so I'm bringing a new person in.
What's wrong with it? What did he say was wrong with HR the way it was before?
He has never really given any details, but that was one of the first things he did. Even before he was officially superintendent, he did this first batch of administrative appointments, and one of those was to take the HR head and put her in charge of a group of schools and say, we're going to find somebody new for HR. Has been searching for quite a while, and as Gwen might want to talk about, he's come up with a new strategy.
Well, when I talked to CMS officials, they did say that they have this new strategic plan that they're working on. What that is, I did not get any specifics on, because I was wondering, in terms of, you guys have, you know, had this job out here, and they said they received 81 applicants for the position, but none of those were hired, and they brought in the interim person from, which bank is it?
Bank of America.
Brought her in, and they said they wanted to take advantage of her skills, and that, you know, they are still in this planning stage. So those 81 applicants, she's on loan.
It's Jerry Parker. She's on loan from the Bank of America. Why not? Why do they hire somebody on an interim and not a full-time forever?
Well, for one thing, Bank of America is still paying her salary, and I'm guessing it's a much better salary than a public school system would pay. I don't know that for a fact, but I think that's a reasonable guess. So they get, you know, you could look at it as a failure to recruit the person that they needed, or you could say this is somebody who's coming in with fresh eyes at basically no cost to the taxpayers, and my guess is that she's going to be serving almost as a consultant as they do this strategic plan and figure out exactly what do we need to do human resources better. And that's everything from hiring and recruitment to dealing with bad teachers or with bad incidents that come up, because that's the kind of thing, when HR is working well, you don't see it at all. And when it works badly, you may see a big lawsuit and verdict against Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. And we've seen a few of those. I think there's probably a lot of that kind of thing going on in private hearings and closed sessions that we don't even know about.
So we're coming up on a year of the tenure of Clayton Wilcox, if you subtract out his being here observing for a while before he took the job or before he assumed the reins of the superintendency. How would you guys assess his handling of the job? What has he accomplished? What hasn't he accomplished? What is left to do? What did he say he would do that he hasn't done or that he has done?
He hasn't made big promises, and I think that in some ways is very different from our other superintendents who came in through national searches. Heath Morrison came in, and he made a big point of visiting 159 schools in his first 100 days, and he laid out this elaborate multiple bullet point entry plan and started talking about bringing in a consultant, Glenn Singleton, to talk about cultural competency. I mean, he was out of the gate, and it was, you know, here's what I'm going to do. Peter Gorman was kind of the same way. And Clayton Wilcox has kind of just gone to work. I wrote a column recently, a blog post that said, if the others came in promising to refurbish the house, he's the guy who's going to clean out the attic first. He's mostly talked about, you know, y'all have piled up an awful lot of initiatives and reforms, and some of them are still there and not really doing much. So his plans to restructure Olympic, which was divided into 5 small schools, and he's going to put it back as one, is something he's doing. But he has not done a state of the schools. He has not introduced slogans. So it's a very different style.
Smarter approach, perhaps, given how many predecessors he's had in recent years.
Some are going to say smarter and some are going to say in over his head. There's, a mix of opinions on everything about education.
And I guess time will tell.
And I think, too, he said that he learned from his past positions and that he's going to listen more this time around.
That's Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News, Dedrick Russell, WBTV News, Liz Bell from Ed and Segan, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.